Good afternoon. Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Dan Ayersman. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, Eco News. You can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Today, my guests are Mark DuPont of Sandy Bar Ranch and Klamath Knot Permaculture, as well as Dan Equinox of High Tide Permaculture. Thanks to both of you for being on the Eco News Report today. Maybe we can get a brief introduction. Maybe, Mark, you can start, give us a rundown on the basics of permaculture.
Sure. Yeah, like I say, my name's Mark DuPont. I live out in Orleans on the Klamath River. I've been involved in permaculture since I took my first course in 1987. There's a few definitions of permaculture floating around out there, but I think the one that's kind of become the most decided on, more or less, is a simple one, which is it's the design and creation of sustainable human habitat. I like that. It's kind of short and succinct. It's got some buzzwords in there, of course. Sustainable is this term. It's been practically bludgeoned to death, used and overused and almost meaningless, but I think it's served an important purpose. I think these days sustainable is used in kind of a shallow and a deeper sense. The shallow sense is just people are thinking of sustain like when you hit a piano key and you just hope things keep going. You get as much and as long of a note as you can out of it. And about every corporation's got some sustainability program going these days. And just it's a buzzword you hear about all over the place. But, you know, the deeper meaning of sustainability has to do with giving sustenance. And I think sustaining refers to sustaining as giving life. And life is based on cycles. Life's a matter of reciprocity. And I think that gets to the heart of permaculture because it's those cycles that we really don't honor in our life these days. So much of our use of materials and energy and resources is just a matter of flowing them right on through our lives without respect to them. Energy takes a one-way path through our homes, gets used once and it's up in the atmosphere and accumulates as carbon. Water gets used and polluted and run right on through. We use it once, flush it down the toilet or put it down the drain, and we forget about it.
It's curious to me when people hear about permaculture, a lot of the time people think about agriculture and how it ties into farming. But as I understand it, it's a system that's more all-encompassing and looks at the more holistic relationships. Maybe we can go back and look at how permaculture started, the origins of permaculture. When Brock Dolman, a permaculture instructor, talks about being on the cutting edge of a 10,000-year-old idea.
Exactly.
And I'm really interested in hearing the background of the school of thought.
Yeah, well, the permaculture itself is a contraction of two words, permanent and agriculture, or permanent and culture. And it was coined by Bill Mollison, who really came up with the whole concept back in the 70s. Doing a lot of reading, you know, you'll look at how people live in places. It's the more permanent and long-term civilizations and cultures are those that manage to find a balance with their surroundings and don't abuse, and mostly their soils and their forests and their water. And so they can stay in a place for a long time. And if you can develop that kind of relationship with a place, then you start to approach a permanent culture. And that's what I think he was trying to kind of capture in that. He read a couple of books that really influenced him a lot. One was called Tree Crops by J. Russell Smith. And J. Russell Smith pointed out that, you know, it's our annual grain-based agriculture that just really exhausts soils, requires a lot of disturbance, requires a lot of inputs. And if you look back at the great Western civilizations and the cradles of them, a lot of these places where these civilizations once were are desert now. And it's not because they weren't productive places. They were places where forests once stood, and after forests were taken down, productive fields. But with a persistent overuse and, I guess, abuse of the landscape, largely based on annual grain culture, and intensive use of the soil and a lack of care of the soil, you lose the soil.
Right.
You lose your culture. You lose the basis for everything else.
Exactly. So when we look at agriculture as we've seen it throughout the course in the United States, and looking, I'm from the Midwest, seeing the topsoil, how many inches a year go into the Gulf of Mexico from the Midwest. It's a really impressive amount. And looking at permaculture and other sustainable systems, it's inspiring to see that there's a movement towards more sustainable systems within the United States here. I wanted you to give us a little bit more of a description about where you live, Sandy Bar Ranch, and what is the Klamath Knot?
Sure. Sandy Bar Ranch is in Orleans, right on the Klamath River. And the Klamath Knot is this term that was first coined by geologists to kind of describe this really complex melange of rock that occurred from the collision of tectonic plates that gave way to the Klamath Mountains. You got the Pacific plate colliding with the North American plate, and that's what created the Klamaths. And it gave rise to this very, very complex set of geology, and in turn, soils. Complex rocks makes complex soils. It's complex in a lot of ways, not just geologically, but ecologically. It's this ecological crossroads. The Klamaths are not the Sierras, and they're not the Cascades. They're neither one. The Cascades are volcanic. The Sierras are largely glacially formed. Neither of those applies to the Klamath. And over eons, when the Cascades were getting vulcanized and the Sierras were getting glaciated and covered in ice, by and large, the Klamaths escaped those episodes. And so the Klamaths became this refugia. So you find an incredible amount of endemism, of huge amount of species that are found there and nowhere else. It's actually been cited as a center of worldwide biodiversity. It's an incredible place. You find a lot of species, a lot of plant species particularly, find maybe either their northern or their southernmost limits in the Klamaths. Alaska yellow cedar comes down and makes it to the Klamaths and no further south. Black oak and tan oak and interior live oaks and madrones, they're all examples of species that find their limits there. Port Orford cedar and Brewer spruce are these relic species that were left over from ages and ages ago, and because we didn't get nailed by the glaciers or the volcanoes, then they survived there.
And how long has Sandy Bar Ranch been around?
Boy, it's been around a long time, but I've lived there for 20 years mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. The place has got a long and very rich history. We're right there in Orleans, which the traditional name for Orleans is Panomnik. Panomnik's got a long story that I couldn't tell because it's a Karuk story, and a Karuk should tell it. But just acknowledge that there's a long, long history there. But we moved there in 1992. The place was started originally as a fishing lodge in 1950. But before that, it was an Indian rancheria where the Sandy Bar group of Karuk Indians lived.
Right. And just to back up a little bit, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the permaculture ethics, the fundamental principles
sure.
of permaculture.
Sure. There's three permaculture ethics. They're pretty simple and pretty profound. Care of the earth, care of people, and limits to growth and consumption. Mm-hmm. And another way of stating that is earth care, people care, and fair share.
Seems simple enough.
It's simple enough, and if you really abide by it, it should disturb you. Because it's not easy to live by that. I don't say those lightly. I drove into town today in a gas-consuming vehicle, and, you know, boy, we face that. I think we should carry that tension around with us. I think we should strive to live by those, and we should be bothered when we're not attaining them. And just because you adapt permaculture doesn't mean you necessarily attain those, but that's your eye on the prize. That's what you're mm-hmm. shooting for, you know?
Exactly, exactly.
And I love that quote that you mentioned by Brock, but not only 10,000-year-old, right. but how about 30-50-year-old? Just look at our grandparents. When I take the time to think about my grandparents and what they were doing, you know, the herb garden right outside mm-hmm. the kitchen, boom, zone one for cooking. You know, it's fall. There's an abundance of food. Let's can the stuff. Grandpa going out fishing and hunting. No coined term, you know, permaculture. Sure. It was just what they did.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the more we think about that within our own culture and our own families and relationships, the closer we realize we are to it.
That's true.
And so when people ask me, what is permaculture? Are you landscapers? You know, what's going on here? I just ask them to take a look at what their family traditions are and how they've been sustainable and how those fit into what we now term as permaculture.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've got Italian grandparents who came to this country as immigrants, and I had the really lucky opportunity to go back to my grandfather's village a couple of years ago and have a look around and kind of see where I came from. And boy, you know, being Italian, it's like I don't feel secure if I'm not growing all my tomatoes every year, you know. I mean, I love growing things, and I see where that came from my parents and my family, and I see how my mom grew up on a farm where she and her family met all of their basic needs themselves. My grandfather actually worked in the coal mines in Pennsylvania, and he went off to work every day, but the brothers and sisters stayed home and ran the farm. And that itself speaks volumes about this huge shift that we've gone through as a culture. In the matter of a few generations, we've been transformed from a producer culture or a provider culture to a consumer culture. And that's just caused such ecological illiteracy, really. We become disengaged with our landscapes. We're at that point where it's hard for people to recognize an unhealthy watershed anymore. It's hard for people to walk, to drive by a field and know whether that's a health, you know whether that's a healthy field or an unhealthy field.
Sure.
Can you look at a plant and tell whether it's a healthy, thriving plant or not? I think our grandparents could, and I think largely by necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, speaking about the Klamath Knot here, we're up in northwestern California, and, you know, we need to recognize that there's really the only sustainable cultures that have existed, I think, on the continent are the native cultures, and their repositories of enormous information that largely goes unrespected and unacknowledged. They are, it's not correct to call them permaculturalists as much as we are trying to maybe learn from them and look to their technologies and their land management policies and traditions.
We were talking earlier about how disconnected we have been, how ecologically illiterate we have become. Looking at both our urban landscape, our built environment, a lot of folks hear about permaculture. It's in a more rural context. So I guess I'm curious, Dan, your work that you're doing around the coast here and working with students, as I understand it.
Yeah. Well, the perspective that we like to take is, and this gets back to before we even get into design, is we have this acronym, and it's PATO, P-A-T-O, and it's protracted and thoughtful observation. So before we even start putting a subjective lens to what we're seeing and making judgments, being very objective and observing through that lens what is happening winter, summer, the whole cycle of the seasons from different perspectives on the same location. And I think that urban settings are just ripe for this because, yes, here we have built environment structures and concrete and thoroughfares and stuff like that, but there's so much that we can utilize and integrate with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done a lot of that on the campus at the school I teach at. And so we have a building and the building is in this location and we have perennial winds from this direction. And there's even topography on the flattest land, you know, visually. But if you really get down to it, water will move on it. Mm-hmm. So where is that water? Where's the source and where's the sink? And working with that. And in fact, today I was going over with my students on taking a look at water and let's just break it down into the math of water. And so you have water falling from the sky over an area, but we can't forget that we're operating in a three-dimensional space as well. And so we have these impervious structures that we've created, like the roof on the building. Of course, we don't want water getting through it because then the building's wet, but there's however many square feet. And then let's multiply that by how many feet of rain in a year, and then multiply that by 7.8 gallons per cubic foot, and look at how many tens of thousands on a school building, hundreds of thousands of gallons of water, which is a resource and it's on site. It's an asset to us. And so how can we utilize it there on site? And how can we take care of it? Because the location of our campus is in the Mad River watershed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's going to end up. After it passes over our roof, through our parking lot, into the storm drain, it's going to end up in the Mad.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we remember that we're a part of that integrated watershed system?
Mm-hmm.
Even here in an urban setting on the coast, sandwiched between the 299 and the 101 freeways.
Yeah, yeah, it's absolutely, you know, I think of the basic permaculture principles are something you apply to any situation. You know, you can use them to design a home. You can use them to design to lay out a settlement. You can use them to lay out a garden. And boy, I mean, we're now at the point where 51% of the world population is living in cities. You know, in many ways, there's a lot of advantages to that, to having high density housing and concentrating our land use in a smaller area. Absolutely, it's one of the critical places, I think, for the application of permaculture.
And being so crowded, our relationships with each other. And so many of those principles can be applied to that. I mean, could you imagine if we thoughtfully observed our relationships with each other and use that to then effectively communicate through those relationships,
mm-hmm.
just how we interact with people?
Well, I think it's an interesting thing. I've been working with working on the general plan update for several years now, and there's a lot of perspectives out there, a lot of divergent perspectives out there. And there's been a lot of debate around increasing density in town or in urban environments versus lower density sprawl in our rural lands. Wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the impacts that we face in both ways, and how we could apply in a more densely populated area, how we can apply those permaculture principles make it feel like it's connected to the landscape.
Well, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, but to pick up on that thread, exactly like what Dan was talking about, addressing impervious surfaces is huge. You know, mm-hmm. but we've really stripped the ecological function of a place when we've removed vegetation from it and put an impervious surface on.
So when you're talking impervious surfaces?
Well, like an asphalt, a roof, mm-hmm. your house.
A lawn.
Anything that basically sheds water. And that reflects our approach to water, which is to pave it, pipe it, and pollute it. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to approach it that way. And the idea of permaculture is you slow that water down. If it's coming onto your property, that's a valuable resource. You mm-hmm. want to recharge. First you want to save it for uses. You want to save it in a cistern or a container or a tank of some ways, and you can use it to water your lawn. You can use it to feed your chickens if you've got chooks. Mm-hmm. You know, you can use it for drinking water. If you're not going to do that, you can recharge it into the groundwater, which is where it was destined for, and slow it down. And, you know, that's actually becoming code in a lot of places. They're requiring most developments now to deal with their own stormwater. And this is something that came out, again, in the very first permaculture books in the 1970s, was using swales, using contoured ponds and swales and integrating designs that take that water and slow it down and infiltrate it in. You can apply the same principle to lawns. You know, the lawns are just an enormous untapped resource in this country. Most of them are laid over prime ag land, mm-hmm. and they're not producing anything. And not only that, they're consuming huge amounts of you know, fossil fuels in the way of mowers and then pesticides and chemical fertilizers. And they can be growing food. And many permaculture designed developments, earlier developments like Davis Village Homes, the Village Homes in Davis, mm-hmm. have shown where, you know, you can integrate. People love to live around gardens. People love to live around edible landscaping. And that edible landscaping can be on all levels and all tiers. You can have annuals in the ground. You can have small annual beds by your house. You can have vines, trellising vines. You can have whole orchards. The trees that you plant in a city, in a town, in a development can all be edible. Mm-hmm. That's a basic premise. Where people live, we should have food.
Yeah.
You know, if people live there, there should be food growing in there. And most of the world, that's what you see.
Right.
You
right.
know?
Right. And I like the point that you brought up, Dan, about visualizing the landscape not two-dimensionally, but three-dimensionally. And in our urban areas, we have the opportunity to stack functions, to stack our growing systems. Mm-hmm. If you have an apartment, three-story apartment building in Arcata, there's tons of opportunity for growing your food on your porch, on
exactly.
your deck.
Exactly, yeah.
And so it's thinking in those ways that's really hopeful to me, and looking at Bill Mollison's book, The Bible for Permaculture Design, mm-hmm. there's a lot of discussion on that.
Yeah, sure, rooftops.
Yeah.
Rooftops
yeah.
are another one. They're just a huge underutilized resource. It's a huge amount of area, and it's really cool to see cities doing these studies now, and they're quantifying how much food, the amount of food that can be grown on rooftops is amazing. The amount of, you know, living roofs, you're seeing more and more cities adopt and embrace the idea of living roofs and the idea of, you know, of catchment, roof water catchment, something places like Australia have been doing for a long time. But we're just kind of we're getting on the bandwagon now ourselves.
Though I guess one of the very important things about this is that this isn't something you have to necessarily subscribe to in one way or another. Anybody can do any of this, and you can do it for whatever motivation you have. It's just about taking a look at what you have on site. What are your resources? Whether it's a balcony or a rooftop, or maybe you have an acre or two of land. And if you apply that time to thoughtfully observe what's happening there, and you look at how it's happening in natural systems, then you're setting yourself up for success in achieving whatever goal that is you're setting out for yourself.
For sure. Maybe we could talk a little bit about permaculture on the West Coast and the courses that are being offered.
Sure. Yeah, I know personally jump in whenever you want, Dan, but I took my first course in 1987 up in Oregon. And that was a pretty inspirational course. It was with Yanto Evans and Aprovecho Institute. And what was so special about that particular permaculture course was it was a two-part course, and the first part was taught in Oregon. The second part, we went down to Mexico, and that was pretty exciting. It was kind of covered the gamut. We looked a lot down there at indigenous cultures and place-based agricultural indigenous cultures, and learned just enormous amount from that. That was 1987. Like I said, since then, there's been quite a lot going on the West Coast with permaculture. We've taught several permaculture design courses at Sandy Bar Ranch. I work with Brock Dolman at the Occidental Arch and Ecology. He's probably got the longest running series of permaculture courses there at Occidental. Penny Livingston is another woman. She and her partner, James Stark, run the Regenerative Design Institute out of Bolinas. Mm-hmm. They run courses every year. So it's really become kind of a grassroots movement, and it's also a grassroots global movement. It's hard to come up with a country that hasn't had a permaculture course in it, and really, it's really pretty widespread.
Yeah, and I think if we look at you saying, you know, the second portion being done in Mexico, and from our cultural perspective here, you know, in the United States, we look at first world and third world. But if we look at it through a permaculture lens, what we classify as third world nations, if we look at them through permaculture, they're actually first world, because they never stopped doing this. They never stopped being integrated with the natural systems, because that's the way they always did it. And then, you know, the developing nations, if you will, segregated. And that's one of the principles, is integrate, don't segregate. Mm-hmm. And so the United States segregated, and now we're moving back to this idea of integrating with natural systems.
Sure. This is the Eco News Report. My name is Dan Ehrsman. We're here today speaking with Mark DuPont and Dan Equinos about permaculture design. So, Dan, you've been teaching permaculture design work, doing permaculture design for a decade now. Is that right?
I've been working in the field, yeah, for about 10 years.
And you're now teaching students on permaculture design, and there's an upcoming workshop at Sandy Bar Ranch. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk about the importance of education in your work.
Yeah, well, I've been teaching in public schools for 13 years now. Once I got into permaculture, the connection I made between that and what I was doing on a daily basis in schools was, this is all the same stuff. This is all about providing people with skills and knowledge to then go out and achieve their personal goals. We see this separation, and I've seen it so often in the school setting, is there's this huge push for school gardens, and there's grants all over the place for school gardens. The first thing that got me was like, oh, this is awesome. Yeah, let's make this happen. Let's get gardens in schools. It's integrated into, you know, nutrition and health and science and math and English and arts and everything, integrated cross-curriculum. But then the farther I got into this, and the more conferences I went to, and the more school gardens I helped develop, the more I realized how segregated it was from what was really happening. And I also had the check-in with, wait a second, I have to take time out of my curriculum to teach kids about the connection between their body, the food they eat, and where the food came from. And for me, that was a turning point. Like, that's how separate we have become. Mm-hmm. So separate that now this huge trend is school gardens, because they're not exposed to that. And we have to literally teach them about, in a classroom setting, how a seed germinates and what makes up a soil and different types of plants and photosynthesis on these basic levels. And so that really, really caught me. What I've really dedicated myself to doing is putting those two things together, my background with education and now my work in permaculture and this community that I'm a part of, and how many people have so many things to provide others with, and really like taking education outside of the box. And whether it's running permaculture design courses, or it's weekly series of community workshops that we do here in town, or CCAT's been around forever doing this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm really wanting to move forward and bring the greater community into sharing what they've got. Because one of the permaculture principles is renewable resources and services. Mm-hmm. that's something we need to look more into, is the renewable services our community can provide, and that's education.
Yeah, I agree on that whole connections point, that we sometimes just fail to connect these dots in our culture, you know, and I think that's like, boy, there's a lot of despair floating around out there as far as where we're headed in general, and there's so much we can do. Like, that brings me to permaculture, because it's about practical stuff we can do here right now. We don't have to wait for a government program, or we don't have to wait for something. It's about taking the initiative to figure out how to meet our own basic needs in and amongst our community, and thereby make our communities more resilient. Yeah. Because that's really where it's at. We don't know what the future is going to bring.
That's right.
We know there's like, you know, we know we're at 400 parts per million in the atmosphere, and we know we're going to get a lot higher before people really pay attention.
Right.
And we're headed down this road. But in the meantime, we don't know how that's all going to pan out, but we know we've got some big changes ahead of us. And if we work in our community, figuring out how to provide ourselves what we need in the way of food, in the way of water, in the way of building and housing, and how to turn to our watershed and turn to our own fields and agriculture and people and community for that, we're just going to be a lot better off, whatever the future. We're going to create a better future out of that.
Right.
Permaculture's got a lot to offer in there. Part of a permaculture design course is just getting your hands muddy and learning about natural building. You learn how to make structures out of what you have at hand, how to build a house. These are pretty simple, pretty basic materials that people have been using for thousands of years to build with. And they're at hand, and they're here, and it's possible to build beautiful aesthetic structures from your own hands with your own local resources.
Yeah.
You know, same thing with food systems. We can design our gardens so that they have a succession of food year-round, even from our perennials, not even just let alone what we're going to plant annually. We can build pest control into our landscape. We can build water retention into our landscape. And none of these are rocket science. It's all very accessible.
Do you have a permaculture design workshop coming up at Sandy Bar Ranch? Maybe talk a little bit about that, what the course is offering,
sure.
When it's going to be.
Yeah, permaculture design course is based on a 72-hour curriculum. Most of them are taught over the course of about 2 weeks. They're residential courses. This is something I've been wanting to do for a while, and it's finally coming together, which is a Klamath Knot permaculture design course. I'm out there on the Klamath River in the Klamath Mountains, and boy, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on out there, as well as here on the coast, and I've always wanted to kind of tie them together. So what we're doing for this course is adopting an extended format, and it's going to run over the course of about 7 months, and we're going to meet once a month. First three sessions are going to be weekend sessions. They're going to be out there at Sandy Bar Ranch, and then the remaining sessions are going to be here on the coast at various places. We're going to be meeting at Thule Fog Farm. We're going to be meeting a whole day at Dan's place at High Tide Permaculture. We're going to be working with Lonnie Grafman, who teaches at HSU. We'll be at CCAT. We're going to be spending a lot of time with Levon Dura of Fungaya and look at micro-remediation and all the different applications of mushrooms in permaculture.
So a whole smorgasbord of activities.
Yeah, it's a long course.
Where can people find out more about this?
sandybar.com, and you can check it out. At this point, I have to mention the course is full. It filled up pretty quickly. But we're going to keep doing. Dan still does monthly. Talk a little bit about the course
that
you do, Dan.
The first and third Wednesday of the month at the Beneficial Living Center on South G Street, right across the street from the Marsh.
Right.
We host permaculture-based and beneficial living-based workshops. You can go to beneficiallivingcenter.com or hightidepermaculture.com and see the schedule of events. We've got great people that come in and present, and they're about an hour and a half, and the last couple workshops were hugely successful. It's very informal, very interactive, where the presenter puts a bunch of information out there, and then it's more like a question and answers kind of sessions. A lot of them are hands-on, done stuff like fermented foods, intro to permaculture, amending soils. The next ones coming up are compost teas.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And then there's the Humboldt Permaculture Guild.
Mm-hmm.
That's our local pack of permies. Several people have already graduated from permaculture courses. Other people are just folks that are interested. It's open to everybody. They have a really fantastic annual event called the Seed and Plant Exchange. And it's very exciting because this year, that's going to be moving to the Arcata
Community Center.
The Arcata Community Center. The Guild is really exciting about moving into a bigger venue. It's a huge event. Boy, it attracts hundreds of people, and everybody brings their plant material. They bring their plants, and they bring their seeds, and it's a whole day of swapping seeds and workshops. I'm going to be teaching a crafting workshop there this year. That's March 31st, last day of March, Saturday, at the Arcata Community Center. And if you want to learn more about the Humboldt Permaculture Guild, just Google them and look online. And they do monthly potlucks.
Great. And the Seed Exchange is an amazing event.
Yeah, don't miss that. Yeah, it's really fun. It's free.
Excellent.
Well, thank you both for being here. This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Dan Ayersman, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guests today have been Mark DuPont and Dan Equinos, who will be teaching the upcoming Klamath Knot Permaculture Design course. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Previous shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call the KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.